So we have John Lewis from the city of Fredericton. John has over 10 years of experience as a transportation engineer since graduating from UNB with a Master's of Science in Civil Engineering. He is currently the Traffic Engineer and Active Transportation Coordinator for the City of Fredericton, where he is tasked with planning for future traffic and active transportation needs within the municipality with the overall goal of improving safety and giving residents options regarding how they move around the city, whether it be by walking, biking, or driving. John has been a lifetime Fredertonian and walks and bikes to work daily year-round. We have Mark Legier. Mark has been involved with trail development, management, and promotion of the Fundy footpath for many, many years. He and his father were instrumental in the development of the trail. Currently, he holds the position of trail master for the trail. He is part of the executive committee of the Fundy Hiking Trails Association, which manages and maintains the Dobson Trail Fundy footpath, which is over 100 kilometers of wilderness hiking trail. He has worked professionally in trail development since 2012, working for numerous projects including Sentier de l'Étoile, Trans-Canada Trail, and has managed the trail revitalization projects in Fundy National Park. He currently works as the Trails Coordinator with the Southeast Regional Service Commission with a mandate to work collaboratively to plan and develop trail and AT connections across the region. We then have Stephen Marr, as mentioned numerous times. Stephen is a huge trail advocate. He is a volunteer with the Fredericton Trails Coalition, one of the most active trail organizations, if not most active, volunteer trail organizations in the province. He's active with folks on Spokes, which is an activity-based organization to get people out on the trails. And he is the touring chair for Vail of New Brunswick, as well as part of the New Brunswick Safe Cycling Working Group. And I know there's probably more, but that's all I have. That's all we're going to get into. Fourth person presenter is Dana Purton-Dixon. Dana is the Director of Community Services for the town of Quispamsis. Dana is a passionate recreation professional with nearly 30 years of experience in the municipal and nonprofit sectors. She is the past president of Recreation New Brunswick and has served two terms as a board member of the Canadian Parks and Recreation Association. She is also the president of the Fundy Recreation Professionals Association. Dana has been a key leader in the active transportation movement in Quispamsis. She was the co-lead in the development of the town's first active transportation plan in March of 2012. And then finally, we have Richard. Richard is a functional planning engineer with the New Brunswick Department of Transportation and Infrastructure. In his role, Richard is responsible for developing functional plans and various departmental strategies. He also works and coordinates with other branches to develop or update new policies and other departmental priorities. Richard is involved at a high level in active transportation. He coordinates stakeholders with DTI staff and is responsible for the development of the updated shoulder policy, which is to include an active transportation component. All right, so our first presenter this morning is going to be John Lewis.
First, I just wanted to reiterate there what Jane was saying. I mean, it's tremendous to see the amount of people here today to talk about active transportation. It's something that, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, we probably never would have imagined we'd be having this discussion in New Brunswick. So I think that's fantastic. I apologize, as I'm sitting in the back, it's very hard to see my slide kind of from the back, but I'll try and give a description in terms of kind of the barriers that I see us facing in Fredericton. I mean, first off, we have a tremendous trail system in Fredericton. The Fredericton Trails Coalition's been fantastic and pushing for that and being very, very supportive and really just, you know, allowing us to have a tremendous trail system. What we're trying to do now is trying to expand on that. So the trail system is fantastic for, you know, recreational purposes, getting around the city. It's the challenge we're looking at now is how do you get to your final destination? How do you get to your downtown core? So the slide I have shown up here kind of is centered on the kind of the downtown core of Fredericton. So we're broken up into by the St. John River, the north side and the south side. The downtown core highlighted right by the river on the south side. We've got trail systems that basically run all around the downtown, coming from the north side via the walking bridge, which is a tremendous asset, from the west with the Valley Trail, from the east with the Lincoln Trail, and then from the south, we have bike lanes on York Street, as well as the trail heading to the university. So as you can kind of see on the slide, we've got a lot of ways for people to use the trail system, get towards downtown, but how do they make that last connection? How do they get to their final destination if they're using it from a transportation perspective? So one of the main recommendations that came out of our last active transportation plan was downtown bike lanes, that whether it's bike lanes, bike tracks, some sort of bike facility in the downtown on street so that people can get from the trails where, you know, people generally feel comfortable to their final destination. The challenge is, of course, that, you know, there's no extra space in the downtown. So I guess what I'm looking at or what our key barrier right now is how do we invest in AT, which there's a lot of momentum for in Fredericton, there's a lot of support for in Fredericton when there's trade-offs. You know, we can't just widen the road. So we're trying to look at, you know, what can be done, trade-offs between narrowing traffic lanes, parking, loading zones, sidewalk space, sidewalk cafes, transit. These are all, you know, stakeholders that are fighting for the same space in the downtown core. So we've come up with some plans. We've done some initial presentations to council, but there's still, it's kind of stalling right now in terms of getting that momentum, because people, we have a lot of positive feedback, people love AT, but we seem to have trouble with people being willing to give anything up. Someone feels like they're a loser when we're trying to look at options for the downtown, whether that's parking for businesses or like I say, those other uses. So it's how do we create enough momentum, I guess, for active transportation to move this forward so we have a better, a better true active transportation network versus, you know, the trail system, which is used, I guess, more recreationally. So that's my barrier right now.
Thanks, John. I'm just sitting here thinking about it, and I'm probably going to put in a few little nuggets here and there just for my observations, having worked in trails for the last, 18 years. But I think about this idea of not in my backyard, and I know that we've all faced that. For those of us that have been involved in the trail development industry, if you think back, even in the city of Fredericton that has an amazing trail network, there's a section of trail on the north side that there are landowners that are still blocking the trail. And back in those days, we had landowners that did not want to give up their land because they did not see the value of trails. And over the years, we obviously have seen that change and evolve. And I really hope that we go in that direction with active transportation, that over time, just like people have seen the value of recreational trails for us to be able to recreate in the evening with our family and friends, and how it's evolved now into a major part of our active transportation network, the same thing will happen with our AT bike lanes, et cetera, that people will start to see them as being important. And I think that, you know, there's been a lot of hard conversations, particularly in the city of Fredericton, where there was discussion around expropriation of land. We certainly don't want to have to get to that point, but I think there is going to be some hard conversations that we're going to have. And I know we're going to be talking a little bit about policy and legislation later on this morning. And I know that Stephen Stone, who was our presenter, was going to speak about that this morning. And he will be here this afternoon, but hopefully Stephen will be able to speak a little bit about that. But it just harkens back to those days, even before my time, which I feel like I've been around for a long time, of how we had to struggle to get trails. And now people still struggle, but not necessarily as much as they had in the past. So I'm certainly sure that there are other people that can appreciate that. And living here in St. John, in a city that has very little space for trails, that we have that problem.
Good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to see this many people engaged in active transportation. So Jane asked us to share a photo that embodies some of the challenges, barriers we have. This is an image of a dike corridor in the community of Hillsborough, New Brunswick. And not only is that an interesting opportunity, so I guess to back up just a little bit, I'm the Regional Trails Coordinator for the Southeast Regional Service Commission, and my mandate is to connect communities by trails and active transportation corridors. And in doing so, luckily I'm from the area where I work, and a lot of these connections are dreams of mine, things I've been thinking about along with many other people for many years. So when I assumed this role about a year and a half ago, I was really quickly able to get to work and start identifying opportunities. So this is a dike in Hillsborough. Ultimately, we're trying to connect, I'm working on a project to connect a trail from Alma, right next to Fundy National Park, all the way to Parley Beach in Shediac. And the idea is to connect the majority of the population in our region, and also to create, this is a really important tourism corridor. So we believe that we can create something that is both a recreation asset for the region and a tourism asset to enhance the economic situation that's already happening. And in order to create a trail, this would be a trail about 150 kilometers, we have to get creative. To your point, John, trail development, active transportation is a battle for space. We're trying to get from point A to point B, and there's already a lot of things in the way. In the world of long-distance trails or any kind of trail, we have barriers like railroads, waterways, highways, and as a result, we have my job is just riddled with challenges and problems, and literally barriers. This image embodies a couple of different barriers and a couple of opportunities. So not only is this a beautiful, picturesque corridor next to water where people like to have trails, it also overlooks a site called a historic site. This is the water right there is the site of the Battle of Petticoatiac, a very important ship battle that most people don't know about. In a lot of places, this would be a National Historic Site, probably should be here. It's also a wonderful opportunity for a recreational trail in a community that that doesn't have a lot of rec assets. And it's not a very well-off community, so trails are recreation assets that anybody can use without equipment or a membership. So the barrier here, and some colleagues in the room, I see them smiling, is we're not allowed to build trails on dikes. That's a real problem for us because the community would like to see a trail here. It's perhaps the best opportunity for a trail, but there's a realistic problem with dikes have an intended purpose, which is to keep seawater off of agricultural land. We believe that there's an opportunity to, and this kind of symbolizes different problems we have. We have challenges with getting across roads where the speeds are high, or using shoulders for different areas, or creating crosswalks to get from one trail point to another. So this is one of many barriers when you're developing a long distance trail. And just for some perspective, to create this 150-kilometer trail that would lead from Alma to Shediac, I'm considering 370 kilometers of options. So we have to walk those. We have to consider the challenges of like traffic and physical barriers and land ownership and land uses. And all of those things kind of go. Oh, also the cost of building a trail on a particular corridor. So we kind of analyze all these options, and in this case, we think this is a really good option for a lot of reasons. But there is certainly still a barrier. And what I hope we'll talk about today is the importance. What I want to get out of today is the importance of having these conversations, planning active transportation corridors or trails. Takes a long time. Those that are like Jane that have worked in the industry for a long time understand the time that it takes. But we have to start conversations, and we might not have a resolution for years, but if we don't start the conversations in good faith and start looking at our options, we're never going to get to that end goal. So we hope that one day we can find solutions. We know that there are solutions for things like dike trails in other regions. We've seen that in our own province. There are many trails on dikes. We've seen in Nova Scotia. It works really well in and around Truro and Kentville. And we hope that we can make the most of these great opportunities, places that have cultural, historic, and ecological value, and have people engage with them. Raise the quality of our lives in these communities, and also add value to other opportunities like our tourism offers.
Great, thanks, Mark. I think the one thing I've heard, and I'm sure we're going to hear it throughout the day, is the idea of working together and sharing challenges and opportunities. And I know that having had conversations with people as we plan this, as well as another forum that we're planning next week to talk about the future of greenways in the province, as well as some of the notes that I've received from presenters, and I know that Richard's going to talk a little bit about the idea of bringing some of these groups together to talk about common issues that I think we do need to have and need to continue to work together. So again, to see all these people in this room, I'm sure that many of us do have the similar barriers, but are we talking to each other? You know, when Mark was talking about the dikes, I went to Acadia. We spent all of our time out in the dikes in Wolfville, and we vacationed there this summer and went cycling and biking and cycling and then hiking out on the dikes. And they're embraced in those areas and used. And I also remember working on a similar project down around Memram Cook, Sackville, trying to access the dikes. So there are a lot of things that we can learn from each other. And then I look to the people from Nova Scotia in this room, recognizing that we also live in a small geographic region. And although we have various different departments and regulatory issues, I think we do have an opportunity to learn from what's going on in Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and to a lesser extent, because it is further away, Newfoundland and perhaps Quebec. But I think that we have to start having some sort of resource exchange in this province so that we can continue to build on the strengths of each other's and lift those up that are having troubles, because we can't do this alone. And I think for many of us, we've been trying to do this alone. So I hope to have that spirit of collaboration continue throughout the day, and I know that it'll probably come up in other conversations. So our next presenter is going to be Stephen. I hope I have your slide in the right order. I do. Okay, great.
Good morning. Nice to see everyone here. When we talk about policy and legislation, the first thing that comes to mind in anyone's head is true. It's complicated. It's got to be a good idea. It's got to suit all conditions. It has to be enforceable. It has to be realistic. But there is also that the point in time that comes when you talk about policy and legislation is the change in socioeconomic values. As was mentioned before by John, back in the 80s when Bill Thorpe and his Merry Band of Six started canvassing Fredericton City Council for to turn the rails into trails and talk to all the people, they were ostracized. There were death threats, and they were even spit upon at council meetings. That's how bad things were, because nobody wanted a trail in their backyard that was going to lead to vandalism and other bad things that happened to families. And now it's just the opposite. People have seen the value of trails, of active transportation routes. The community, it brings the community closer together, and of course, property values, if you have a trail close by, are increased. So when you talk about policy and legislation, it's a very long road. So I just like to put the vision forward that pretend everyone here, as you're driving on the road, you've had your driving course, you're educated drivers, but there are no laws. There's no Motor Vehicle Act. Okay, you're out there, you're driving, and it's all based on goodwill and common sense. Okay, that's what we have right now for cyclists on the roads in New Brunswick. Okay, it's all goodwill and common sense. People would make the argument that, well, how is that enforceable? A lot of police constables, RCMP, we spoke with, when it comes to cycling with helmets, turning, going through stop signs, they will turn a blind eye because the law is not there. There's various circumstances for them to issue a citation, but the law is just not there. If they go to court, the law does not support them, and the cyclist can make the argument, and it's a wasted day for the constable. Okay, so the laws and regulations, that's only a starting point, but it's also the foundation. And that's why the working group, we got together after Ellen's Law, and we approached the government, and they agreed to have monthly meetings working towards a strategy to safe cycling in New Brunswick. And And of course, like they say, it's all done by a team effort. And Brian Gillis, Wayne Aerosmith is here. Sheila Cameron, who was one of the forces in Ellen's Law campaign, and Gary Crowley. Brian is not here, but he actually went through our Motor Vehicle Act line by line and compared it with Nova Scotia's and Quebec's and Ontario's and Maine's, and realized that we had nothing. We have nothing in our Motor Vehicle Act. So he highlighted everything, and there's copies of this back in the corner there if you so wish. And there's 28 different articles there just to bring us up to par with our neighbors. Okay? We highlighted this in a white paper to the government 2 years ago. And then, of course, the government changed, and we had a meeting with the safety minister. And he told us straight out he thought Ellen's Law was it. He said, well, we've got Ellen's Law. Isn't that enough? So Ellen's Law was only the precipice. And now we're into the void, because there's 28 different articles, not to make us better than the other provinces, not to make things more stringent or safer, but just to bring us up level with the other provinces, our neighbors. And so we're still proceeding with that. They have their copies, but it's all about priorities. And right now we're not a priority. But that is the foundation, and we're fully cognizant of the fact that a law without being enforceable, without having everyone aware, without having everyone educated, without having other benefits such as recreation, tourism, health, and then on the end of the day to look back every year and saying, okay, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? And then adjust accordingly. But that all starts with a strategic view and a plan. Because without a plan, as mentioned before, you don't know when you got there, and you don't know if you're doing it wrong. So regulations and laws, policies, it was pointed out to us that we submitted the paper with the articles for change, and discussed them at length. And they are, in fact, reticent to open the Motor Vehicle Act, because it's not just us. We have the oldest Motor Vehicle Act in Canada, the most out-to-date, to put it bluntly. And there are a lot of changes and a lot of other special interest groups. So the observation was made that we can enact a lot of these changes in regulations. And so the registrar, the motor vehicle registrar, was very favorable to this fact, and he actually made that recommendations and started looking at how to enact these as regulations as opposed to a law. So that's basically where we're at now, because the government changed, the new government has other priorities, and hopefully, as the big village, we will come together, and the bow wave will elevate the awareness to our outdated Motor Vehicle Act, and slowly head towards change so we can join our neighbors.
Thanks, Stephen. I think what I took from that, and I'm just sitting here thinking, this was done by volunteers, and you had a volunteer go through the Motor Vehicle Act line by line. I think that's astounding to think that there are volunteers, and I think for those of you that, even if you work in it, I'm sure you're probably already volunteering, spending time volunteering, but this was done on the shoulders of volunteers to find all these elements within the Motor Vehicle Act that do not align with the other provinces. And so that, again, is something that I think if we can work closer together as groups, we could probably spread some of that heavy lifting and create a stronger network. But I think that just really struck me as being the fact that a volunteer went through that. And I know there's a lot of people that are doing great work, but I wouldn't want 10 volunteers from 10 different regions of the province going through the Motor Vehicle Act, all doing the same thing and coming to the same conclusion when we could have all been doing that together. So it's again, another opportunity for us to have that conversation today. I'm going to hand it over to Dana now, and I know that she's going to be talking about something that I'm really interested around education. I think that it's going to be important to start to educate people about what we're trying to do. So,
thanks, Jane. The town of Kuspamsis adopted our first active transportation plan in March of 2011, and since that time, we've had two other documents that I believe the active transportation plan have been critical in forming, and that's our branding. A process, we went through an extensive community consultation process with that document, as well as the municipal plan. And in both of those documents was a town vision. And I believe that our active transportation plan was a key player in creating that vision for the town. And that is that Quispamsis is a forward-thinking community where families enjoy a safe, friendly, active lifestyle surrounded by a beautiful and natural environment. The first year of our active transportation plan in 2012, where we decided as a working group to hire a summer student, and they promote active transportation plans and information in our community at different events and in the schools, and they've been doing that since 2012. We knew we had to create a culture of change, and it was like recycling. We knew we had to start with our youth. The students coordinated trail walks with KV Walkers. They had annual trail day events, a BMX park competition, a BMX bike competition at our dirt jump park on Chelsea Drive. We also assisted the KV police with their skateboard park competitions. They've been attending events, Area 506, Canada Day, our marigold plantings. We had an AT swim. However, our biggest impact has been with our active transportation presentations to the schools. We've reached well over 8,000 youth since we started in 2012, over 1,000 a year. We go to all different grade levels. We initially started with all grade levels, and now we're focused on elementary schools. And the annual presentations have different themes. We started out, of course, with what is active transportation, and then we moved on to helmet safety, bicycle safety, etc. Education and awareness are critical, as AT is more than bike lanes. It's all more non-motorized forms of transportation. It is the movement of people. So creating a culture of change, making healthy choice the easy choice, has been the focus of our working group. Since the creation of our active transportation plan, we've built 8.5 kilometers of new trail. The trail system is now part of the Great Trail, and one piece in particular that was part of the Great Trail had 28,000 users last year. We groom approximately 7 kilometers of trail in the wintertime, and we've also created safe access at Quispamsis Elementary School, Quispamsis Middle School, and Chris Saunders Schools, and we've partnered with the school district to do that. They snowblow that access throughout the winter. And again, we're trying to make the healthy choice the easy choice. So for a lot of our families and their subdivisions, they drive the long way around, or you can walk and take these short access points to the school. And they've been very successful partnerships with the school. We've painted over 400 sheros in our community. And in fact, we work with our works department now to paint all of those lines and all those sheros that are being put down on the road. We have monthly meetings with the working group that I mentioned. It's an interdepartmental working group, and we've been meeting every month since 2013, and I think it's one of the most collaborative and engaged committees of our town. We have representation on that committee from our engineering department, our parks and facilities, community services, and planning department. And I think this was key in breaking down our silos and communications amongst our departments, which can happen. AT doesn't belong to recreation, it doesn't belong to engineering, it doesn't belong to public works. It requires the whole organization to come together and take ownership for their role in that.
Thanks, Dana. That kind of actually just goes back to the first question that we had about who does the active transportation for the city of Fredericton, and John said, well, that's me, because it doesn't fall nicely. And I always think about that with trails as well. Nothing falls nicely, so to find a place to put these things is often really difficult, and people just sort of slough it off as being, oh, well, someone else will take care of it. And until we find that place or that home for active transportation, it becomes difficult, and I know that there are lots of communities that are starting to find that. I'm always a huge advocate when it comes to education. Again, having worked in the industry for years, I think it's really important to engage people, and I think children are one of our greatest ways to engage and get people out, because they'll want to show their parents what they're doing. There's the walking school bus and those types of things. But the one thing that also struck me with what Dana was talking about, and I'm just thinking back, we moved to Newfoundland in 2013, so it was before that, and I was here in a meeting, and I stayed out in Quispamsis, and I remember seeing the sign, so it must have just been after you started 2011, 2012, And I started seeing the signs pop up in Quispam Sis, and I thought, wow, this is progressive for a bedroom community outside of St. John doing this kind of work. And, you know, you start to see those signs, and then people start to ask questions. What is that sign? Why is that sign there? And it's those baby steps that need to be taken in order for us to start recognizing what's going on. And the other thing, too, is that idea of changing the culture and changing the way that we think. Do you believe that Quebec had a culture of active transportation 20, 30 years ago? Probably not, but they had to start somewhere. Now when you go into Quebec, you see signs everywhere along the highway talking about watching for the cyclists, talking about active transportation programs that they have, and they had to start somewhere. And I think that, and you know, we have a rural province, but we also have some urban areas that are being proactive, but we can also implement these things in rural areas. And I think a lot of times people think, well, it's not our culture. Well, if we don't start changing the way we do things and the way that we act, it will not be our culture. So if we are adamant that we want to see change, we need to start walking the talk and doing things. Every little bit helps, and I think that's what's important. That's why I think education is really important. We have to start somewhere. If we choose not to start, then we will not get anywhere. And you know what? There might only be one person that sees that sign or asks that question, but that's one more person that's asking about what active transportation is. So when you start to see the sharrows and you start to see the share the road signs, people will start to understand. And then education programs. I know for the project that I'm working on with the Wollastook Valley Trail, we're looking at how we're going to cross a major highway bridge because we cannot at this point afford to build a $10 million bridge across the St. John River. So what we're going to do is implement a very big education program to ensure that people understand how to cross the bridge. But it's not just for the people that are cycling or walking, it's for the people that are driving across the bridge as well, so that they understand that they're meeting people going across these bridges. We don't have all the money in the world, and would I love to be able to build or add a new trestle to this beautiful train bridge across the St. John River? Absolutely. But we also have to recognize that within this, you know, we have to have some fiscal responsibility, and until we can demonstrate that people are using the trail and crossing the roadway and there is a demand for that bridge, we are going to have to use other things. So education to get people across that bridge safely, both from a cyclist and walker perspective and a driver's perspective, is going to be important. So I think education, in the absence of being able to do a lot of changes from an infrastructure perspective, is very important. So that's why I always believe that education, regardless of whether it's active transportation or trail development, is really important. So I appreciate having that. Sure.
I just want to add to that, if I could, Jane. We took a lot of heat for those signs when we put those up there. I think it was $24,000 we spent on those signs, and we got a lot of negative feedback from the community. But what's helpful was key messages to us was we needed to start with the youth and the culture, and we actually had people report to us that adults that they didn't know what the signs were, but they were driving with their kids in the car, and the kids told them what that sign was. And I will also share that one of my kids, I was dropping them off at school, and he had his bike, and he was going to go biking after school. And at that school at the time, the bike rack was back with the dumpsters behind the school. Now the bike racks are at the front of the school, and the bike racks in Quispam Sis are full. And I think that our active transportation working group has a lot to do with that. So we have seen movement, but I just wanted to share those two little stories because there has been change, and there's more to come, and definitely, most definitely. But I think education awareness is certainly been key in our community.
Yep, no, that's great. I guess our last speaker is going to be Richard.
So that's the Burton Bridge in or close to Oromocto. Does anybody know that bridge?
Cycled across it all the time.
Right. So I've cycled across it many times too, and it's a scary bridge to cycle across it. You're not supposed to be on a sidewalk if you're cycling, but if you are, the guardrails are not high enough, so your seat is higher than the guardrails, so it's kind of scary. On the shoulder, well, you can see the shoulders, they're not in really good shape. I have a road bike, so my road bike would pretty much be destroyed. So really the only alternative is the center of the lane. But it's got a pretty big vertical curve, so you got to sprint across it and make, essentially you got to gamble that no car is going to come behind you and kind of rear-end you. But the cross-section of the bridge, the cross-section is actually pretty typical. We've built those bridges in the 60s, and they're somewhat narrow. They have very narrow shoulders, and often no sidewalk or pretty much a very narrow sidewalk, which is unusable. You can't really walk across it. It's difficult to cycle across it. And this bridge, you know, also has that vertical curve, which it just makes it even worse. So you know, we have about 1,000 of those prior to 1970s bridges, and you know, they're all kind of similar, and it's a challenge for us because they often end up on cycling routes or proposed routes, and they're really bottlenecks, and they cannot be fixed easily and so on. Usually it requires a lot of capital, requires a lot of planning and so on, and it's not always available. We can't just retrofit a bridge to make it larger. It's not done really frequently, and it would cost also, in most cases, millions of dollars. So I just wanted to talk about that one bridge, but also have a few more talking points that we kind of often encounter. Is that one of our big issues at DTI is that non-physical barriers, you know, I'm kind of talking about paint on the roadway. Paint is really, the primary purpose of paint is to delineate the lanes on the roadway, and it also delineates the shoulders, which can be used for cycling. But our main concern is that if the shoulder is not wide enough, essentially there's not enough room, so it's a non-physical barrier, so it means that cars can still traverse it if they break down, but also if they're inattentive. We're not supposed to text and drive, or we're not supposed to look around you too much, but it happens, and you know, collisions do happen. So that's a pretty big problem for us, at least a concern for sure. And then a design that encompasses some of the new bridges that we build, especially in municipalities, do have those wider shoulders, and they do have sidewalks that you can walk on and so on. But sometimes they don't connect to anything. So sometimes there's cases where they've been built, but on either side of a road there's nothing. Maybe because it's in a rural area, or maybe because the municipality has no intention to connect that, or no intention to connect that in the next 5 to 10 years. So sometimes the infrastructure gets built, but it's not being used. And then space is also another issue for us when it comes to adding, using shoulders for cycling, especially the lack of lane. In the recent past at least, we have not expropriated lane for the purpose of cycling. It's not been done, and it's unclear if it would be even possible, because essentially the greater good needs to be proven. So it needs, essentially, the loss of lane from the landowners need to be smaller than what the cyclist would win, if you want, by adding wider shoulders. So, you know, it's all those things that they add up, and it makes, you know, developing cycling routes and trails on the road a lot more difficult for us. We need to collaborate with the stakeholders and the landowners and so on. And one of my last point also is, we work with a lot of groups. There's groups in Edmonton. We have groups in between Green Falls and Woodstock, the Willowstock Trail, and we have the Coastal Link and the Villa Route, and the group in the southeast, going from Alma region to Shediac and so on. And many of those groups, they don't communicate between each other or among each other. And so we have different requests for different type of design at different times, but the lack of coordination does create a bit of headaches for us. It creates more meeting, more papers, and more of everything. You know, if we compare that, I guess, to the Blue Route in Nova Scotia, where they have a very large network or a very large proposed network of cycling infrastructure in Quebec, where they got the La Route Verte, which is mostly separated from the road. That was really led by one common organization that was overseeing essentially the entire project. So for us, you know, the lack of, I guess, coordination among the stakeholders is it does create some headaches for sure. And then the last one is really, I guess, you know, money. Capital is it competes with other priorities, and competing with motor vehicles is quite difficult, as I'm sure y'all are aware. And yeah, I mean, those are really the main barriers that I've seen working with trails and all kind of infrastructure, whether it's cycling on the road or whether it's off road, and so on. There's all kind of issues, and it's not just the infrastructure; it's also, you know, the other side, the softer side, if you want.
Great. Thank you, Richard. I do want to thank you for participating in this panel, because I think oftentimes, and I'll be a little blunt, when it comes to, you know, a lot of frustration, it comes back to DTI, unfortunately. But I think it's really important for us to have the opportunity to have Richard on the panel and have other DTI staff in the room to be able to answer some of the questions, because it's certainly, you know, Richard has outlined a lot of things that do create challenges when it comes to creating safe active transportation networks. And we are burdened with a lot of old infrastructure in this province. We don't, as I mentioned before, have a lot of money to be able to create these wonderful, you know, a cantilevered bridge off the side of that, you know, for cycling would be lovely, but that's certainly not an option. So we have to understand and work together. And I think that's the other thing, as Richard mentioned and I've mentioned earlier, working collaboratively together. I've worked all across this country, and I've seen some good things, I've seen some bad things, and we're certainly not at the top of the good things. We're certainly not, we're at the worst of the worst. But we do need to work more collaboratively together. And one of the things that I proposed, because I am working with the other major Greenway trails, is to at least create a network on behalf of those groups to have a voice within government. But we are also looking at, again, this idea of having a Greenway network so that we are able to bring a common voice to government, whether it be Department of Transportation and Infrastructure, Tourism, Heritage, Culture, or any other of the departments, that we can speak collectively and speak knowledgeably, and so that we can work together. But yeah, I do want to thank you for being on it, because I know we worked hard to get someone from DTI, because we knew that it was important to have someone here to speak to the challenges, because I think oftentimes they become a punching bag, and it's not fair if we don't have them in the room. So thank you very much. I will now open the floor to questions. What I'm going to do is go down on the floor, and if you, rather than having people come up, if you have a question, I'll go over with the mic, and then I'll ask you guys to share the mics, or if stand up and speak. So I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but let's go. Let's do this. All right. Do we have any questions? Samuel.
So thank you. Up in Batters, we have great recreational bike trails, but it doesn't go to downtown. The first, John, you mentioned, how do you get people to the final destination? Right now, council is not, unfortunately, quite not on board on spending a lot of money, but there's still maybe a little hope that if we could get a consultant to look at our streets and say what's possible, what's not, or returning a few streets in one lanes, and etc. And it would have to be fairly low cost for it to pass for next budget. So where do we start? Where do we get a consultant to look at our street and say what's possible, what's not, at a fairly low cost? Who do we start with? Where do we call? What phone number do we ring?
Crandall Engineering, WSP, EXP. I think EXP. I mean, there's a number of different firms that do active transportation plans. I mean, certainly we can connect, and I can, I guess, share some of those those contexts. From the city's perspective, I guess in Fredericton, it's really, it's not, we didn't intend to do it in terms of moving infrastructure, so it would just be restriping, delineator posts, that type of thing, extra signage. So the costs aren't astronomical. We find that, I guess, the bigger challenge is with the business and potentially taking away parking or adding, you know, any type of traffic delay anywhere, actually probably a bigger challenge than just the dollars and cents. But yeah, so I mean, if you're going down that route, my recommendation would be, you know, if there's a business district or business improvement area, you know, get them involved right from the ground floor and see if you can get them on board with you know, seeing the benefits of those connections into downtown.
Good morning. First question directed, or comment directed towards Dana. As you know, I'm a resident of Quispam Sis. we do have a wonderful trail system, but my comments are more towards sharrows are the bare minimum, and I'm wondering why the town hasn't moved towards putting bike lanes, which would be the next step up on the Old Hampton Road. I know we redesigned the Pettingill Road a few years back, and we didn't put bike lanes there. There's sharrows. I would call it a barrier towards people who want to commute from any one of the subdivisions and use the Old Hampton Road or the Pettingill Road to get to the downtown area.
When we first started our active transportation plan, we worked with our consultant, and we talked a lot about bike lanes and versus shared routes and sharrows. And at that time, and we're again talking about 2010 when we went through our public consultation process, the research at that time indicated that there was the perception of safety for cyclists in those lanes, not necessarily that they were safer. And we also knew at that time that we would not have the political buy-in for bike lanes, because of we weren't going to be widening roads, so to speak. I think for us as a committee, we decided, again, in working with our consultant and our active transportation plan, that shared routes would be, for us, more successful, where you can share the routes between walking, running, and cycling. And I would expect that in our transportation plan, which will be encompassing active transportation as part of that, that there may be a change in that philosophy at that time, but that's where we needed to go in order to get started.
Okay, thank you. Second comment to Richard. You said it's difficult to get the stakeholders as far as active. I would say it's also a lack of leadership, and not comments not directed at you, but lack of leadership at the political level, the senior bureaucrats, doing anything as far as active transportation. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Just wanted to thank the organizers first for holding this. I think if Ellen Waters was here, she'd be really happy to see that we're actually taking action and trying to prevent more people from getting hurt on the roads. My name is Simon. I'm the director of La Baikerie, the bike co-op in Moncton. I'm so happy that everyone talks a little bit about Vélo Québec. It's a topic that Mark knows that I talk about it a lot. I lived in Quebec for 6 years. I also gave bike tours to kids during summers. So I know the green route, or La Route Verte in French, in Quebec very well. My question is more, well, for anyone that wants to answer it, in Quebec, they have, like, they started building the routes in the 60s when Vélo Québec started to really get active. And now they have thousands of kilometers of green routes all over the province. But they connected the idea of cycling on these routes or walking on these routes with tourism and heritage, meaning that when you go on a trip, you can plan your trip for a week or 2 weeks. You go from one section, you make a loop. You have all these planned stops, the bed and breakfasts. You go to vineyards to taste some wine. You go to different farms. You go visit heritage or historic monuments. Everything is planned out. So there seems to be some kind of collaboration between tourism, between transport and infrastructure, between heritage, and also with the environment, promoting ecological ways to get around, with the ecological crisis happening very soon. Like, these are things that we can all talk about and are definitely economically viable. I'm just asking, maybe it's more also for Richard, sorry, we're going to ask you a lot of questions. Do you guys talk with each other? Like, does different departments have a vision to kind of come together and have this kind of idea together and just look at Quebec and just be like, hey, they have success now. And infrastructure for cycling lanes is a lot cheaper than streets, right? Because we don't break them. They break a lot less if you bike on them. So I'm just wondering if these kind of talks are happening at the provincial level.
Yes, but more reactive. We're more reactive than proactive, at least at DTI. I can't speak on the behalf of tourism and heritage and culture, but at DTI, we're more reactive as to if someone comes to us and says, well, we have that proposed route, we want to go from point A to point B to point C, and we want to go there, then we're going to say, well, okay, well, that's not going to work, but let's look at alternatives, essentially. So that's more the approach that we're doing. And then we consult other groups, and we're going to often bring in tourism and so on. But in most cases, it's tourism that comes to us and asks for our feedback and our input, because they've been working with a trail group or a group for, let's say, a few months or a few years, and they're at the point where, you know, they need our input because they want to essentially use the infrastructure that, you know, DTI owns and maintains. And at that time, we need to step in, and that's where we try to accommodate as best as we can, I guess, you know, within a reason.
I'm just going to jump in, just although I'm not sitting on the panel, I'm moderating it, and I don't want to speak on behalf of the department, but I am working on the Wollastoq Valley Trail and have been involved in the Trail Action Plan. So I'm sure that you may be familiar with the Trail Action Plan and the 11 yeah. identified signature trails within the province. Yeah. Since that time, there have been other trails that have evolved and developed, including, I call it Mark's Shoreline Trail, but the Shoreline Trail. So if you look strategically at the way that the four cycling signature trails are set up, we have the Vedelut, which is in the Acadian Peninsula, which encompasses most of the Acadian Peninsula, Shoreline, which would run from Alma to Shediac, so you basically have a nice good chunk there. The Wollastoq, when complete, will hopefully run the length of the St. John River. Right now we're focused on Grand Falls to Woodstock. And then we have the Coastal Link Trail by its name right now, which basically runs from St. Stephen to St. John. So if we can strategically look at those four trails, there is an opportunity to link those to create a network. And then within those networks, we had the City of Bathurst, which would connect into the Vedelut. We've got, you know, Edmundston that could connect into the Wollastoq. So I think your point is well taken, and I've done a lot of work with Vélo Québec and worked with Louis Carpentier for years and years, and we do take a lot. And I also look at Ben, what's going on with the Blue Routes and the work that they're doing in terms of strategically linking up with the trails within Nova Scotia around Harvest Moon, Celtic Shores, Rum Runners, and how they're connecting that into the Blue Routes. So we do have something to learn from Quebec and Nova Scotia, and I think that your point about looking at how active transportation can be connected into tourism is really important, and environment, et cetera, because I will always say from a tourism perspective, and although my background's recreation, but I've evolved into tourism, is we have to look at the trail for all the uses. And even though I'm working in it from a tourism capacity, I have to think about the people that are living in those communities and what that's going to do for them, because they are the ones that are going to sustain that trail through the long run. It's not the tourists that come in for 2 months of the year that are going to be using that year round. They may bring in the greatest economic impact from a tourism perspective for the accommodation, et cetera, but it's those people that live in those communities that benefit from the well-being, the community connectedness, et cetera. So I think that the idea of linking everyone together to have that conversation so that, again, it's not active transportation, tourism, environment, all having separate conversations, just like we're having the idea of stakeholders not talking in isolation, needs and various initiatives should be brought into the conversation as well. I know Mark's. Yeah.
So I think, like Jane said, a lot of the trail proponents or trail managers, we're talking to each other. I look around the room and I see all kinds of people as a trail manager that I talk to that are also managing trail or developing trail, and we share stories, successes, and we actually aren't that siloed. We kind of organically have rallied together through a variety of ways, and just through events like this we get to know each other. We often share our challenges, our barriers, and we have a lot of things in common. To Jane's point, and I don't want to single out, or I don't want to pick on DTI, but we do often have challenges. We recognize we are way down the list of priorities, and I understand why. I understand that we have the highest number of roads per capita anywhere in the country. We understand that climate change is having harsh effects on our infrastructure. We understand that with all those things in mind, we fall quite a ways down. We also, or I'll speak for myself, and I think people that I work with feel the same way, we don't want to be a burden. We don't want to waste time. We're constantly trying to think and strategize as how do we be the most efficient and most productive when we do collaborate, and what are ways that we can work our way up that that priority list. Are we not advocating for ourselves in the right way? Are we not demonstrating the value of what we're trying to develop? That's where I think I'm speaking for some people in the room. That's where we often find ourselves. We don't want to be that pain in the ass. I know that I often am, and I'd rather not be. I'd rather be working with people and focus on solutions rather than the barriers. That was a question or comment.
I think it's evolved into something more, but no, that's good. I mean, I think, and I again, looking to Richard and perhaps other DTI staff, what can we do to help facilitate the process with DTI? Because I think it must be difficult to be in a reactive position all the time. So I think your comment about collaboratively working together is coming as a common voice, I think, is something that's important. And I think that's the idea, is that we do want to work collaboratively to make sure that we aren't that squeaky wheel, although squeaky wheel does get the grease, but the idea that we can come and work, we work with, not against, and work how we can work collaboratively.
I live on the west side of St. John, and pretty much every day I look at that bridge and imagine that I could ride my bike to Uptown in about 5 minutes. And I think in a recent news article, I think there was 84 crossings attempted in the last month that the St. John Police Force had to deal with. Given that would be a very risky activity, I think it kind of shows how important it is for people to cross that bridge other than in a car. And then my personal experience, I moved here from British Columbia, and in that community, we saw a real tipping point in active transportation when the city hired an active transportation coordinator, and they were focusing on two key areas, which was schools that had the highest number of students that either walked to school got priority in terms of active transportation upgrades. And secondly, the city acknowledged that road diets were a way for the city to cut costs.
Tolls, well, it used to be federal when it was built, when tolls were still in and so on, and then it was, I'm not sure how it happened, but we got it now. So since then, there's only a couple of bridges in the province that cyclists cannot be on, including the Jemseg River Bridge and St. John River Bridge on Route 2, and Princess Margaret Bridge, I think, in Fredericton, and the Arbor Bridge too, I suppose. And essentially those structures, DTI was recognized that it's just not okay to, you can't walk on a bridge or you can't cycle on it because the level of safety, I guess, is not there. There's not enough room for it, and there's no good solutions or no easy solutions for it in those cases. And it's never really been looked at, as far as I know, from our perspective. And maybe when that bridge gets replaced in a couple of decades, something might be done. But until then, I don't see... Personally, I guess, not speaking for the TI, but I don't see what could be done in a really cost-effective way. But if we're talking about the reversing falls, that's different. But I know there's a large sidewalk there, and it's a bit slower and so on. But the Harbor Bridge is a big bottleneck, essentially, for AT.
Thank you. My name is Donna Reardon, and I'm a counselor with the City of St. John. And one of the barriers for me is I need to hear the voice of active transportation, because we already know in St. John that we have 20,000 vehicles that are coming into the city every day. Compound that with the vehicles that are already here, and I hear about potholes all spring. That voice is strong. And then just recently we heard about Mackay Highway madness. You know, like, hello, it was, you know, an extra whatever it was to get into town, but the voice of the vehicle is very, very strong, very entitled, and very demanding. So then when I look at the budget, I see all this money in the budget for roads. And I am I'm a big supporter of active transportation. I'm a walker. I don't want to use sand on our streets, the sand-salt mix. The city tells me we have to do it for whatever reasons. It's too slippery for walkers and bikes. There's all kinds of issues. So I guess for me, it's amalgamating that voice and making sure that voice is loud and clear, because I need to hear it at council to convince, you know, all of the councillors that this is the way we need to go. And we're not hearing it strong enough relative to the car driver. So anything you can do, like even with the, like we talked about earlier, about amalgamating with tourism and all those other things, those voices, that if it comes as one voice, I think it would have more strength. So that's a huge barrier for me, because like I said, I got to hear it so that we can try to move some of that forward. So appreciate this session today as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm going to go over here because I've got a couple of people. The one thing I want to let everyone know is we are taping this session, so we've got about 15 minutes left, but we are taping the session so we can transcribe the comments that were happening that have come up. And I also don't want to cut the conversation short because we are going to have a break, so I would encourage people to continue the conversation after. I want to do a bit of a wrap-up, but I think we're probably going to run right into the break, so I just want to let people know that we are going to try to capture this through notes so that we can take some of these and make them actionable. And I'm happy to have one of our city councilors here today, because I think that this is a great opportunity for those of us that live here in St. John to create a stronger voice, knock on council chambers doors, and have a conversation to make sure that we do get active transportation on the agenda. And perhaps we won't be able to cross the Harbour Bridge anytime soon, but we'll be able to look at how we can, you know, reduce the impacts of the traffic jams that we had in the Mackay this year and this summer, etc. So I've got, I think, two here, Andrew and then Andrew. Yeah.
Hello, everyone. My name's Graham. I work for DTI. I just want to give Richard a quick round of applause for coming out here and speaking. Almost dropped the mic. Anyway, I just recently came from Calgary, where I was at a Canadian Urban Transit Association meeting. And I just had a quick question for John Lewis. I was wondering if the city, as the transit coordinator, if you interact with the transit side of it and try to find complementary uses. For example, Fredericton's on a big hill. Is there any deliberate plans to, I don't know, take the trails to a place where they could meet up with buses and get people to the top of the hill to Regent Mall or anything like that? Or even parts of the trails where they're less accessible due to the hill?
Yeah, definitely. We're very, very closely with transit. One thing, they've just completed a transit accessibility plan. So being familiar with Fredericton, I mean, a lot of our transit stops are just on the side of a busy road. And, you know, the reason that that bus stops at that location, because, you know, 30 years ago, Jim took the bus, and that's in front of Jim's house. So now when we're going in to look at, you know, actually upgrading these stops with pads and sidewalk connections or trail connections, it's an opportunity to, you know, don't just put it back because that's where Jim used to live. It's, oh, we've got a trail, you know, 40 meters down the street. Let's move it closer to the trail, connect it to the trail. Certainly those discussions are happening. You know, I mean, we mentioned it a few times, dollars and cents. If any infrastructure upgrades, you know, cost money. There's a lot of federal money right now that's available for transit. So we're looking at how we can tie, you know, transit stop upgrades with AT to take advantage of some of that federal money. But yeah, that discussion's definitely happening. It's just, it's a slow process.
Hi. My name is Andrew Holloway. I actually bike that bridge, and to put it in perspective for people who don't know how bad that thing is, there was a gentleman who spent 3.5 weeks in the hospital hitting a pothole when he got pinched on the other side of that bridge this summer. because it was either take the pothole or get hit by a car. My comment, my parents were really involved with the salt marsh trails in Cole Harbour, just outside of Halifax, if anyone in the room knows that area. It's a big thing that connected basically the back end of Cole Harbour to Lawrencetown Beach, Sidney Crosby sign, like landmarks of Dartmouth kind of thing. But my understanding is that, especially at the municipal level, taxes for roads come in through homeowner, like your home taxes. It's not from gas necessarily. So I really think there just needs to be, we have in this province healthy eating advocacy. You go to health, they have people whose whole job is to advocate for health. We in healthy eating and nutrition, we have people like myself for recreation, physical activity. We need to have a unified voice in this province that is advocating where myself and my wife equally pay taxes into Fredericton as someone who's driving an F-150 to the downtown core. Their voice or their tax base, I'm up in Poets Hill, is no more, no less than theirs. But there's no unifying force to say this is an actual priority. So what happens is it gets pushed to the sides of everyone's desk. How we connect gets pushed to the sides of the desk. And I really think provincially we need to figure out a way to have one voice so when we go to DTI, when we go to the municipal planners, we have a group, an organization saying that this is important, this is the way forward, this is how we can work. It's not necessarily going to be a silver bullet that, you know, works in every region, but it's still like a nutrition policy. You're going to have the best shot working with all the partners around the table. Because to me, it's just like everyone, clearly it's disjointed, and you need to advocate to government because they're never going to do it unless we show them that everyone is on board with this. All the taxpayers want this, you know, as much as everyone else. Because we're one of the poorest provinces in the country, but we have like the highest ATV and snowmobile usage. So that math doesn't make sense when you look at the economics, but they still have a very powerful voice in this province. And I think we, if in active transportation, need to come up with a plan together, working with NGOs, working with DTI, working with government, to come up with some sort of system like that. And then we can start really advocating for each other. That was just my thoughts on it.
That's perfect. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you. Jacob Kilpatrick from EXP Services. Question and I guess comment for Richard, kind of to echo Mark's comment. We can appreciate that DTI does as much as they possibly can with the resources they have and the infrastructure they have to handle. One thing you did mention, Richard, the shoulder policy that you guys are actively working on. I could appreciate that that is more of a proactive activity that you are taking. What's the status of that? What does it encompass, and how does it include active transportation?
So the current shoulder policy dates from 1991 or two, something like that. And at the time, the shoulder policy was really to say, okay, well, you know, you got a car, and how much space do you need if you break down? How much space do you need to be comfortable to travel on the roadway and so on? So, you know, that is over 25 years old now. So 2 years ago or so, we engaged a firm to do a scan across Canada and to really look at what other provinces are doing you know, with respect to the shoulders and how they're allowing cyclists and people that walk to use the shoulders and so on, and in what respect, what are the circumstances and so on. So in what cases are they letting them do it, and how much space do they need? So we're almost done the review, actually. I just got the final draft on my desk 2 weeks ago. So with that draft in hand, we'll be able to really look at it, review it with all the staff in DTI. So far, really only a few people have seen it. But once all the staff has seen it and so on, we'll be able to get in a room together and try to draft, a section or amend a section to the shoulder policy and to try to include active transportation, to consider cyclists and people that walk as well, and to try to really encompass all the modes essentially of transportation in the policy. And as for timelines, the policy was supposed to be finalized last spring, this spring, I guess, but in 2019. But really, I think it'll be more like summer or fall 2020. it's just been pushed back quite a bit, and we ran into some trouble along the way and changes in priorities and so on. It's been dragging a bit, but it's still ongoing. So it's not like a dead project. It's still making progress.
Okay, and I guess just a follow-up to that, you mentioned earlier about how when different trail development groups and proposals come in, it becomes a challenge for you because you see different design strategies and different strategies to develop these trails, so you're kind of, DTI is having to look at a whole bunch of different things. Once the shoulder policy is complete and all the different trail development groups have this common document to look at and say, okay, here's DTI's shoulder policy, here's what we can do, here's what we can't do, will that improve kind of the efficiency of DTI's review and how they can process those sort of designs?
Hopefully, yes. So right now, often when we review a proposed trail, the best we can do is to say DTI is likely to do that or not likely to do that, because truth is we don't really know what is safe or what is enough or comfortable for a cyclist. If the road is posted at 50, at 60, or 80, or 100, we don't really know. Should we add a buffer to a buffer with painted lines, rumble strips, or rumble strips with gaps? There's a lot of things we've looked at, but we're still looking at trying to really organize all the best practices, because it's very different across Canada, and really to try to see what's the best thing out there really.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks so much to the panel. That was fantastic.